With that, we are ready for the second case on today's calendar. So please come ahead, make yourselves come forward, make yourselves comfortable at counsel table. While the lawyers are doing that, I'll ask the marshal to call the second case, please.
Case A240667, Low Rob Properties LLC et al. Respondents versus Robert Rodel, appellant.
And counsel, please take whatever time you need to settle in. I'll make just a few quick opening remarks. So you probably might have heard this if you're in the courtroom earlier. I just want to welcome you to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're very much looking forward to having a conversation with you today. I'm sure you're familiar with our procedures, but I just want to remind you that the podium is adjustable up and down. So please make it comfortable for you as you make your remarks. Also note that the microphone should be adjusted so that it captures your remarks. We do prepare a recording of today's proceedings. There's also a live stream available. And that recording is later preserved, the audio recording, on the court's website. And so we appreciate if you cooperate with us at the microphone. It also helps us hear you. Before you start your remarks, we want to have our record really clear. So please identify yourself as well as the client you represent, and then pay attention to the clock. We enjoy our conversation, but time tends to go quickly. So watch the time limits. So with that, counsel for appellant, we're ready for you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Kennedy. I represent Robert Rodel. He's the appellant and the defendant in the court below. I have three basic points about Mr. Rodel's attempt to dismiss this case. The first is that the applicable statute, which is 322C.0701, subdivision 1, does not support Lori Kingston's desire to dissolve the four LLCs that they jointly own.
So, counsel, if you don't mind, and I hate to interrupt your introduction, but I'm just not sure what you mean when you say the statute doesn't support the dissolution request in support of your motion to dismiss. So are you really saying that as a matter of law, the statute doesn't support it, or is it because of the facts alleged in the complaint or something else that I am missing?
Both. The law does not support it. Based on the facts that were alleged in the complaint, and so I'll go through those allegations, but also if the allegations were enough to support it under the statute, there would need to be a trial to determine whether those facts would support such a claim.
Right, here's what I'm trying to get at is to understand. I mean, I understand that you've challenged the district court's decision to deny your Rule 12 motion to dismiss, but I'm unclear because at the same time you also moved for summary judgment. There was a motion for summary judgment on the opposite side. So is the motion to dismiss as a matter of Rule 12 really in front of the court when the parties went ahead and offered evidence and the district court made a decision based on under the summary judgment standard, made a decision? I want to separate out whether the summary judgment's proper, but you know, it doesn't even make sense for the court to look at the Rule 12 issue. It just seems to me you weren't prejudiced by the Rule 12 ruling because the court went on and analyzed it under the motion for summary judgment. Am I wrong about that?
You are right about that.
Okay.
That started off as a Rule 12 motion because the pleadings themselves did not justify relief. The court considered it under the summary judgment standard because the plaintiff offered facts that they said would justify relief. And so, and those facts were not in or referred to in the complaint that was filed.
Right, but we've gone beyond that. I mean, in fact, discovery was closed, right? It's an unusual time for a party to move under Rule 12 after the close of discovery, right?
It happens sometimes that by the time you actually get to court, things have progressed in the process of...
Right, which makes... I appreciate you also filed for Rule 56. I mean, so why not just go there, counsel? That's what I'm asking you.
Yeah. In this case, I don't think it matters. because even the facts that were alleged are not sufficient to justify even a trial, because they don't rise to the level of actions that would create the situation that would justify relief under that particular statute. And we are looking for kind of the key language, the reasonable, practical, practicable to carry on the company's activities. So we have a situation where the parties had an MCA, a member control agreement. And in that MCA, you can basically protect yourself by limiting the duration of the LLC, and you could do that in the articles too, of course. You can set triggering events that either terminate or lead to a buyout, and these MCAs had those. And you can preserve the right to sell your shares, and these MCAs had that as well. So Ms. Kingston has the right to sell her shares, subject to a right of first refusal and some other issues. But instead of doing that and taking advantage of the rights that she negotiated, she wants instead to dissolve the company and deprive Mr. Radl of his ownership as well, in a company that really is suffering no. It's a stable company. They own real estate. They don't have an ongoing trade that would be subject to market pressures. And so she wants to take advantage of this particular statute and say, no, we'll just dissolve the whole thing. But the statute itself doesn't really support that. The statute is for something more major. It specifically cites to the articles and the operating agreement to say, let's consult those to see if the ongoing operation of this particular LLC, or these in this case, would be inconsistent with the articles or the operating agreement. And there's nothing alleged to be inconsistent with them. In fact, they allow the ongoing operation of the company. It's just that Ms. Kingston may sell her shares if she desires to, and then the company can continue operating. Instead, she throws these allegations, starting first in the complaint with the oppressive conduct of Mr. Radl is refusing to accept the price that Ms. Kingston says should be paid for his shares in an appraisal. And Mr. Radl does not accept that. He wants to continue operating the business and thinks that he will derive a better benefit by doing so.
But didn't he also allege that he is entitled to more than a 50% share because of the work that he put into the properties?
That's true, because he is the one that actually improved these properties, and so he thinks that he will get compensation for that by the continued operation of the business. And if she wants to terminate that short of that, then she should pay him for that profit that he would get if they were to continue the business.
But that's contrary to the controlling agreements, though, which call for 50% ownership, though, right?
In the case of a dissolution, that is permitted under certain triggering factors, but none of those triggering factors have occurred.
But didn't she also aver that part of the goal was, one, to make money off of these properties, and then at some point sell the properties for a profit as well?
That's possible. The parties may do that. They may also acquire properties, and they've done that in the past. But there's nothing in the last, almost 20 years since they since they improved the last property, nothing that would suggest that now suddenly the parties should sell the properties. There's nothing that would lead us to that conclusion to say now she suddenly has the right to sell the properties when that hasn't been ca the case in the last 20 years.
Well, I mean, people do that. It's very common for people to do that. Buy property, make a profit on it by renting out, or have an income stream, have the property increase in value, then at some point pull the trigger and sell the property for a profit, and either take the profit or roll that over into other properties. But that's a very common scheme. And basically, that's what she said the goal was here. The goal wasn't to hold these properties until one or either one of those owners die, like a home. These were real estate property. This was an investment strategy, right?
Ms. Kingston may be saying that now, but she has not been saying that over the last 20 years. There's nothing in the operating agreement or the articles to suggest that that's the case. In fact, the articles and the operating agreement both suggest that this may go until someone dies. There are provisions in the operating agreement for somebody that dying and what happens to their shares. It's to state now that that's someone's desire in something that other companies have done may be true. It may be here desired and maybe what other companies have done, but
well,
it's not this company.
Yeah, and let me take a step back. I think, just to be clear, you're arguing that the district court erred by implicitly denying your motion for summary judgment, correct?
Correct.
And when we look at the summary judgment motion, we view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Correct.
And so we have to view the evidence in the light most favorable to her, including any averments that she makes. And so why is your client entitled to summary judgment when it appears that there are enough statements that are made and looking at the controlling agreement to support this moving forward at a minimum, or another way looking at it, that your client is not entitled to summary judgment?
I agree wholeheartedly that the court must look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And in this case, we have this affidavit, as you say, that Ms. Kingston would like to sell the properties. We clearly know that. That's the basis of the whole action. And so that's true. Let's take it for the fact that that's true. And let's take it from general knowledge that other companies sell properties. That does not mean that this company must do that, or that this company cannot continue to operate the way that it has for 20 years and still be a viable business, that operating it is somehow inconsistent with the articles or operating agreement, because that is the standard that the court applies.
What about the issue of deadlock? Because the Barkalow case from Iowa, that's one of the things that they looked at, is whether or not you have an unbreakable deadlock between the parties. The 50-50 ownership is the classic case of when you have a deadlock, when the parties can't agree.
It is virtually the only case, because otherwise there's no deadlock. If somebody negotiates for a majority share, then there's no deadlock, or has an out through an operating agreement, unlike this case where there isn't out. But in that case, the court did find that, no, we're not going to dissolve the LLC. In the other cases cited by the respondent, we have the Saunders case. That's a Connecticut case. I had a case like that, an appellate case in Minnesota, where, yes, the defendant was a scoundrel and lied and cheated. And in that case, you can say, yes, relief is warranted under this sort of statute. In the Kirksey...
Different statute, right, counsel? I mean, different section of this same...
A different section of the same statute,
of
yep.
This same statute.
Yeah,
right?
And that's in the Saunders case, there was misconduct. That's what I'm saying, in the case cited by the respondent. In the Kirksey case, a South Dakota case, it was complicated by the fact that there were tenants in the building, and those were owners, and not all of the owners were tenants. The court said, in that specific situation, yes, we can use the statute. But then 11 years later, in the Dysart versus Dragpipe Saloon case, the South Dakota court said, no, if it's just even ownership and half want to dissolve and sell the properties, and they did own properties, and the other half want to continue, there's nothing that says they can't continue. That's not in violation or any disagreement with their articles or their operating agreement, and so the court did not dissolve.
But in Dysart, you had two owners that had 25% ownership. It wasn't the 50-50, which differentiates that from the Barkalow case from Iowa, which, when you have two people that are own one half, that's when you get the deadlock. So it seems like those facts are different then.
I wouldn't distinguish the two, because two are on one side and two are on the other, 50% here, 50% there. I don't see a distinction between those dynamics. The issue is, does anybody have the voting control to make a change that they want to make? And the answer is no. So that's the deadlock, and that's 50-50 or 25-25, 25-25.
Well, to take it a step further, as we mentioned earlier, we discussed earlier, your client claims that he's entitled to more than 50-50. So right there, it seems to be creating an issue of dispute.
There is a dispute, but only in the negotiation of a price that Ms. Kingston wants to negotiate to sell her shares outside of the operating agreement.
Let me clarify that, counsel. You're saying that the assertion of your client that he is entitled to more than 50% is only in the this current situation where Ms. Kingston wants to dissolve and sell the properties, not on an ongoing operating basis.
That's correct.
My question wasn't
no,
clear.
That is correct.
Okay, so on an ongoing operating basis, your client does recognize he's got 50% ownership, entitlement to 50% of the distributions, et cetera.
That is correct.
Okay.
I don't have much time yet.
Well, I guess I'm still struggling with your request for summary judgment. I was first struggling with the motion to dismiss. I couldn't understand why that's in front of us. I'm still struggling. It seems to me when I hear your argument, maybe I'm missing something. You are suggesting, I think, that there's an issue of fact and the district court made an error in not seeing that district of that question of fact and granting summary judgment in favor of respondent. So, and how would you be entitled to summary judgment, I guess, is what I'm struggling with, because it's really two very conflicting views of what this LLC should do upon the retirement of one of the two members.
I'm saying that the facts alleged by Ms. Kingston, which are things about painting over light switches and name calling and sending an email to a city employee, that those are not the standard that would justify a dissolution. If that standard, you'd have lots of businesses.
The district court disagreed with you on that, right? I mean, the district court did go ahead and look at the conduct. That is a different provision in the statute. And I guess I thought you were suggesting that part of the statute wasn't in front of us. Am I wrong about that? You think that's also in front of us? It's the conduct, oppressive conduct provision?
The only section cited by the plaintiff in this case was the one that I'm citing, which is 322C.0701, subdivision 1, which is about the reasonable practice.
Talking to us about the conduct, right? And that's certainly included in Ms. Kingston's affidavits and submitted on summary judgment.
It is. And our argument is that those facts don't create a standard. There's no legal standard in Minnesota that says those things would justify a dissolution. And if they did, lots of businesses would be subject to dissolution. But even if they did, we would have to have a trial to determine whether those facts exist. That's my client's worst case scenario, is there's a trial to determine whether those facts are true, or those allegations are true.
And thank you, counsel. Of course, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is William Cottrell, and I represent the respondent, Laura Properties, LLC, which also includes 3427 Garfield, LLC, 3504 Cedar, LLC, and 3045 Harriet, LLC, as well as Lori Kingston. Your Honor, I'm here today, of course, to ask that the Court of Appeals affirm the lower court's decision in its entirety. My client has moved to Douglas County. She's retired. She takes care of her parents, and she doesn't get along at all with Mr. Radel. In fact, the relationship has soured to the point where there's been some serious name calling, refusals to leave her house, and he's unwilling to resolve this 50-50 business in any reasonable manner. She's wanted out for a long time. She's negotiated. She's was forced to bring this lawsuit because there was no way that he would buy her out. And so this was the only forum that we could find for her so that she could sever this relationship and move on with her life.
So, counsel, I'm trying to dovetail your argument and description of the facts, and we are familiar with the record, with the statute that you're proceeding under, right? So there are the two separate provisions upon application by a member where the court would have authority to dissolve an LLC. And one is the ground cited in your complaint. which is the reasonably practicable to carry on the company's activities in conformity with the articles of organization and the operating agreement. And maybe I missed it, but at least to your opening statement, it didn't seem like you were alluding to that. Am I wrong? I mean, I don't understand where you're connecting it to the operation, the company's activities in conformity with the articles of an organization and the operating agreement.
If I understand you, you're not wrong. I think that I'm interpreting reasonable practicability to include all of the things that I listed in my opening statement today. And so I think
you had such a strong emphasis, and I understand why under the record, you know, with Mr. Radel's conduct and the inability of the two members to cooperate further going forward. But what I'm, as the ground that you're citing, and like I said, was raised in your complaint, is talking about reasonable practicability to carry on the company's activities, which is owning and operating, leasing these rental properties. And I don't see in the record any evidence that there's been any impact on the LLCs, various LLCs, their ability to carry on their company activities. So help me with that, counsel. If this is your statutory ground, I'm just not seeing the connection with your proof.
I think the groundwork is laid out in the pleadings, the affidavits, and all of the filings. And it does lay out that.
Is there evidence in the record that suggests that this, you know, friction between the two members has impacted the company's activities in conformity with the articles of organization and operation?
Yes, I think so, Your
How?
Honor.
Okay, tell
I
me.
I think so. They're 50-50 owners, and they can't agree on anything. They can't agree on how much money he should be paid. They can't agree on...
If the sale goes forward, you can't agree. I mean, that's the argument we got from... Appellant's counsel, that's the only disagreement, is if the company was dissolved, the two members don't agree on how to proceed.
They can't agree on whether or not to sell it. They can't agree whether or not to do anything with this business.
What about ongoing operation?
Well, they've got tenants.
Okay.
They collect rent.
Okay. So the ongoing operation is okay.
These three duplexes are operating, but they're 50-50 owners and they need to agree on how to go forward with this business. And
well, what it seems to me that you're saying is that we have LLC organization documents that don't contemplate retirement. Am I wrong about that?
I don't think you're wrong about that.
I couldn't see it anyway.
Right.
Documents. And so your only recourse is to go to the court to seek a way out under retirement, is it for the retirement that Ms. Kingston seeks. Am I right? Is that?
I think you're right. Okay.
So here's my question for you, if that's right, because the documents do anticipate, and you're familiar, I'm sure, with our LLC statutes, they do anticipate that all members have a right to withdraw or disassociate, right, from the LLC.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that is an option for Ms. Kingston, right?
She's tried that.
Okay.
Unsuccessfully.
And what do you mean by unsuccessfully? Because as I read the documents and the statutes, any member can choose to withdraw or dissociate. It's a unilateral decision. So what do you mean unsuccessfully?
She's unable, in order for her to sever this, she'd need to reach an agreement with her 50% partner and they've reached a deadlock. They're not able to resolve this. She can't just walk away and say, I don't want anything to do with my three duplexes. Maybe I'm not understanding the remedy that you're suggesting.
What's your understanding of withdrawal or dissociation as a member? It's different from dissolution, right?
I'm just listening to the plain meaning of the words, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're not, there are provisions in the organizing documents that speak to withdrawal and what happens, and that a member is not entitled to distributions upon their withdrawal. They are entitled to distributions later, but not upon withdrawal.
I may not be familiar with
Okay.
everything
All
that
right.
you're suggesting, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You go right ahead.
My clients argue that the trial court correctly dismissed the appellant's claims that the complaint lacks sufficient detail. Minnesota's notice pleading standard allows for short statements of fact without requiring detailed allegations. The complaint notified the appellant of the claims for dissolution based on the breakdown in management, meeting the requirements under the Minnesota Revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act.
Counsel, are you referring to the motion to dismiss under Rule 12 or the summary judgment?
The summary judgment where they indicated that our complaint wasn't specific enough. We're a state where we don't have to provide detail about the grounds. And so we kept it real basic instead of putting out we didn't want their fight to be broadcast in the public. And so we chose to keep the complaint very general in nature. It's our contention that the undisputed facts justified the summary judgment, with evidence showing the impracticality of continuing the LLC operations due to an unresolved deadlock in a deteriorated relationship. Minnesota law and similar cases in other states support dissolution under these circumstances. Kingston's relocation and her continuing disputes over LLC management rendered joint operation not reasonably practicable.
So, counsel, I thought one of the significant pieces of evidence that you offered the district court and Ms. Kingston's affidavits was that the purpose of the LLC included an eventual sale of the properties for profit that the parties would split 50-50.
Yes.
And I noted that, you know, in Mr. Radel's affidavit that the purpose of the LLC is different. It's described as an ongoing purpose to own and manage the three rental properties, period. So is that a dispute of fact about the purpose of these LLCs that then must go to trial? I mean, I'm struggling to reconcile that stark contrast in the two affidavits. There are other contrasts, but that one is pretty big one, with the district court's decision to grant summary judgment in your favor.
You ask good questions, Your Honor. I just can't accept, despite what you just told me about Mr. Radel, that it's his intention that they operate these three small duplexes in perpetuity. They're simply business partners, and that's all. As Mr. Reyes, not sure I pronounced that correctly, pointed out, it is routinely expected that you invest in duplexes and at some point you sell them and move on with your life.
So our trouble here is that the LLC statute says that LLCs are created with the assumption that their duration will be perpetual. So, and we don't have a term limit in your LLC documents.
I can't change the LLC documents.
No, of course not. And we can't change the LLC statutes. And,
no.
And as you know, I mean, practicing in this area, I mean, the statutes are there for a reason. They're to provide terms that are omitted by, you know, certain contract documents. In this case, it's the LLC documents. So I guess I appreciate that there's a conflict between the two members as to the duration of this LLC, but that's not included in the organizing documents, right? I mean, I didn't see it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And when we're looking at summary judgment, your motion for summary judgment, now we need to look at the facts in the light most favorable to Radel.
That's true.
And in that sense, he does say that we were supposed to operate this in perpetuity. And there's nothing in the documents to indicate that that is not the case. And there's nothing in the statutes to indicate that there should be an assumption that these properties will be sold for a profit. So looking at the evidence in light most favorable to Radel, Why was summary judgment appropriate for your client then?
Well, I believe the Judge Conroy got it right that she, and I think her decision goes into detail about that. That, and even in her, even in the transcript of the proceeding, my client is retired. She's moved to Douglas County.
But those are facts that are favorable to you, to your client. For a motion for summary judgment, the district court has to look at the facts in light most favorable to appellant at this stage and assume that they are true. What are the facts, what are the averments, I should say, made by appellant that would support the district court's order granting summary judgment to your client? Seems like there's enough facts averred to raise an issue of material fact to go to trial rather than to be disposed at summary judgment.
All I can say is the court did not come up with that conclusion, and in fact found that, you know, there was that he didn't have sufficient facts to warrant continuation with this business.
Why is the affidavit not enough? They did file an affidavit that says there is no previous issues, no major issues that they haven't been able to work out, and that the business can continue with the appellant being the accountant going forward. So why wouldn't that be enough to create a fact issue that they are not in fact deadlocked for the operating agreement?
The court didn't find that affidavit to be credible.
But the district court does not make credibility determinations at summary judgment. And so that's one issue. The second issue is, while you're relying on what the district court did, our appellate review of summary judgment is de novo. We would give no deference to the district court at all.
I understand, Your Honor.
So why didn't the district court err then, if we take your argument at face value that the district court made credibility determinations? Isn't that contrary to how summary judgment should be evaluated?
I believe that the judge in the lower court addressed all the affidavits and simply did not find that there was enough in his affidavit to justify proceeding ahead to trial. It appears my time is up. Thank you.
No, thank you, counsel.
I have very few points to address because you've fleshed out all the meaningful issues so well. I will go back to this issue of the affidavits. And one of the things that I wanted to raise was that the motion brought by Lori Kingston had her affidavit, in which no allegations of conduct between the parties were alleged. It also had a responsive affidavit by Mr. Radel, in which no issues of conduct between the parties was alleged. And that was the factual record for that motion. And the court found that...
Counsel, the parties were making cross motions for summary judgment. And of course, I read your brief on this. I appreciate that Ms. Kingston's second affidavit was submitted in opposition to your motion for summary judgment, but you have raised that on appeal. And so the entire record is in front of the court. The rules of that relate to Rule 56 indicates that the district court can refer to other matters in the record that obviously the parties have had notice of. which you did. So I guess I'm struggling, counsel, with why we would somehow bifurcate off the second affidavit of Ms. Kingston.
I'm saying that the affidavit of Ms. Kingston was properly submitted in response to the motion by Mr. Radel, but the
right.
court cannot rely on that and accept those allegations as fact.
Well, link that over to Rule 56, counsel, because it says the district court can rely on other matters in the record in Rule 56.
Okay. Let me address it a different way. If you make factual allegations on which you wish to rely for a summary judgment motion, the other party, the respondent, must have an opportunity to address those in their own affidavit.
And why didn't you have an opportunity, counsel?
We didn't because it wasn't submitted as part of Ms. Kingston's.
Rule 56 gives you the opportunity to move to submit supplemental responses. If in this case you find yourself in the position of filing a reply and you would like to file additional evidence. So Rule 56 contemplates that, counsel. I don't see that you are in any way hampered from responding to the second affidavit of Ms. Kingston. Am I missing something under Rule 56?
My understanding is when you have, I mean, going under Rule 115 of the general rules, you don't have that.
I'm not talking about the briefing. I'm talking about Rule 56 because
right.
That's where we're at.
Right.
Okay.
I don't know that right exists. So.
Okay.
If
All
I missed
right.
that,
you.
I missed that, but I just don't know that right exists that you could ask.
I actually wanted to ask you about your counterclaims.
Yes.
That were asserted in your answer, and you did pursue those on summary judgment. Well, I put it this way, Ms. Kingston did, and she was successful in getting summary judgment against you on your counterclaims. I didn't see that briefed by you on appeal. Did I miss that?
You did not miss that.
Okay, so you're not pursuing your counterclaims. Those are over.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Last issue is the sanctions. The sanctions motion was brought because the complaint was filed under a statute that I'm getting the sense there's an evolution of understanding that statute does not really apply. Other states have not applied it in that way to say if there's a deadlock, that automatically gives you a right you didn't negotiate for, and that's the right to dissolve your LLC. And the oppressive conduct that was alleged in the complaint was my client's not willing to agree to the terms of dissolution that Ms. Kingston proposed. That's not oppressive conduct in the same way about the operation of the LLC that the statutes were meant to address.
He's offering to sell her shares, right? Not necessarily dissolve, like just sell the shares to your client?
No, she was offering to dissolve. She wanted
to dissolve
and sell the properties. The sale of the properties would determine the price. So that's the mechanism that she wanted to pursue, but that would dissolve
Got it.
The business. There is a provision where she could sell her shares to anybody. If this is a business that has three duplexes, it surely has some value. And so she could have found a buyer for her shares. That would be consistent with the operating agreement. That to her must not have been her most profitable avenue. And so she didn't want to pursue that, but that's really the avenue that she chose when she was designing the operating agreement would be available to her. And so she's limited to the choices that she made available to her when she was negotiating with Mr. Radel about how they were going to run their businesses.
Counsel, you in your brief, unless I missed it, for your motion for sanctions, I didn't see any case law or authoritative citations to support your argument that the district court erred by denying the motion for sanctions and granting summary judgment. Am I missing something there? And if not, why isn't that issue waived?
Are you saying it's not in the
arguments
in front of the court?
I didn't see legal authority to support, unless I missed it, for the motion for sanctions issue.
Well, the legal authority is the statute. 541.211, if I recall correctly, where this action was filed, it doesn't have any legal support. The action itself does not have a statute upon which it can rely that applies to their situation. And so the statute has provisions that support my client's claim to sanctions. That's all I have. Thank you very
any
much.
Any other questions for the panel? Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate hearing from you. It helps us in our deliberations. This matter is now submitted to the court for its consideration. We will issue a written decision within the statutory timeline. So thank you for that.